Claire Case and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks. I got just a few little notes, and I'm going to get through with those, and I'm going to get them out of the way. First, I want to say thank you to the committee for asking me. And I want you to know I came on faith, on Bob's faith. You know, Bob called me, and I said yes, and then we got ready to leave, and we got here, and people said, asked us before we left, do you know where you're going? I said, I don't know. Well, who are you going to, you know, who are you going to meet? And I said, I don't know. You know, I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know how far it was going to be. I didn't know where I was going to stay, and I came anyway. And I came on faith. I want to thank Bob and Juanita. This afternoon, they took us to some of the most marvelous little places that the cathedral and the castle, and I felt like a queen, you know, and just very, very special. And then there was a couple that walked in yesterday evening, not knowing that this conference says, you know, you have to come ahead, and just happened, there happened to be an opening, a room. And this couple came from Florida, and they moved there about a year ago. Less than a year ago or something like that. They're real special in our life, and it was just one of the greatest gifts we could have had. They came here. They drove all night, and I would you welcome Fran and Terry for me? You know, love you guys. Last night, we had one of the most wonderful meetings I think I've ever sat in my whole life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, you know, the topic was, what, you know, let it begin with me. And I'll tell you, it's, I got to get on with some of this lighter stuff because, you know, I think I'm going to cry. I tell you, the most marvelous, marvelous thing in the world is that this lady's standing up here tonight. And I feel like a baby in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is the greatest opportunity I've had in a long time. Because, you know, I walk into meetings in Indianapolis, and there's most of the people are, you know, I'm one of the oldest members in my group, and or in the groups that I go to. And here I'm just one of those little tiny babies, and I love it. Absolutely love it. And it's one of the most marvelous thing in the world, you know, for me to be able to just take. And that's what I'm doing, man. I'm going to take you all back home with me. Now, you know, my Al-Anon's here, and you're going to hear from him in the morning. But you're going to hear from me now. And first off, I want to tell you, I'm going to get comfortable, and I got to tell you about my little cowboy. I did say I was Claire and I was an alcoholic. Oh, God, I'm glad of that. And I met this little cowboy when I was in treatment in 1978, Batesville, Indiana. And he taught me an awful lot. He taught me I ought to watch what I pray for because God may give it to me. And this little cowboy was riding across the range one day, and there was a snake that crossed his path, and he stopped his horse just before he crushed that snake. Snake looked up at him and said, for that, I'm going to grant you three wishes. Now, you got to think, this little cowboy was really the, you know, he's scrawny, and he wanted to be the John Wayne type. And this little guy looked up at him and he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I want to be as handsome as Rock Hudson. I want to have the build of Mr. Atlas, and I want to have the sex and the sex drive of this horse I'm riding. Snake said, granted. Next morning, that little cowboy jumped out of bed, and he ran to the mirror, and his belt would have put Mr. Atlas to shame, and he was handsomer than Rock Hudson, and he looked up and quickly looked down, and he said, God, I forgot I was riding that damn mare. Now, that taught me I had to watch what I pray for, because God may give it to me. Now, I told you, you know, I got this Al-Anon here that you're going to hear tomorrow morning. And one of the things that I want to let you know in the 11 and a half years that I've been sober and 12 and a half years that he's been sane, you know, oh yeah, you know, and we've been married for 42 years. We have, that's through the fellowship of the program and God's blessings, you know. We have debates, you know, we call them damned arguments is what we call them. And every once in a while we have one of those arguments or debates. And one morning, you know, Carl and I were having one of these heavy, heavy debates, and he turned to me and he said, "Besides that, you're not even good in bed anymore." And God, that really hurt. I don't know about you guys, but it's been quite a while, you know. And this guy looked at me and said that, and I was really hurt. And he left and he went to work, and later he called. He got thinking about it, and he called, and he was going to make amends to me, you know. And the phone rang and rang and rang, and I didn't answer. He called back about noon, and the phone rang and rang and rang, and I finally answered, and he said, "Where were you?" And I said, "I was in bed." And he said, "In bed? It's noon. What were you doing in bed?" And I said, "I was getting a second opinion." Now, part of that story's true, but I won't tell you which part because I slept with John last night. Oh, I love the laughter. I don't want to ever forget how I cried, but I love the laughter. It was penny ante poker, and it was weekend parties, and it was booze, and it was normal for my family to drink. My family would, you know, we'd get together on the weekends, and my family would ice down the booze, and they'd get at the cards, and they'd gather around this table, and they would start dealing, and they'd start playing poker, and everybody's having a good time, and before the night's out, man, I'll tell you what, their attitudes changed, and everything started to happen. The door started slamming, and people started leaving, and things started throwing, you know, were throwing here and throwing there, and they would say, "God, you know, we're never going to speak to you again." And the next week, they'd do it all over again, and I thought, "God, I don't understand this. I don't want to ever grow up to be just like them." And I did. I did. I grew up to be just like them. There was a day in our lives that we did exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. I'm the one of three children. I'm the oldest, and I have a sister and a brother. And my brother's in the program, and he's kind of the joy of my life. You know, the thing is that I go around trying to, you know, went around trying to get him sober, trying to keep him sober, and he didn't have the right sponsor, and he still doesn't. You know, he doesn't go to the right meetings. He still doesn't. He doesn't go to enough meetings. See, these are the things that were going on in my life and in my mind, and I kept trying to edge in there and try to lead and to guide him. You know, I'm 15 years older than him. I know exactly what this kid needs. And, you know, he got sober in spite of me. And he's 5 years sober. He'll be 6 years sober in August. And, you know, he's just doing fine. Goes to a meeting now and then. If that's what it takes, you know, that's okay. But, you know, I couldn't stay sober on what he does. But, you know, all I can do is put him in God's hands, and it does scare me at times. I joke about, you know, he got sober in spite of me, but he did. You know, one day, finally, you know, I finally just had to let go and let God and put him in God's hands and walk away. And maybe one meeting a week or one meeting a month is all that man needs, but someday, somewhere, I believe that, you know, the booze will talk to him. And, you know, I just pray that he makes it back. My mother was a controller. She controlled the kids. She controlled our house. And she controlled my dad. And, you know, I'll tell you what, I used to pray, "God, I don't want to ever grow up and be like her." And I did, man. If everybody in Clara's household does exactly the way Clara wants them to, I'm okay. I like to be spoiled, and I want things my way. And I just retired. Oh, no, I just quit. He retired. And I want everything done today. And so I'm learning that I've got to back off and just kind of be quiet and take it one day at a time. And that's real hard for me because, see, I'm on the go constantly. I can't say my dad was an alcoholic, but I can say he was a real sick man because on June the 25th in 1975, he put a gun in his mouth and blew his head off. And God, that bought me a lot of drunks. I was drinking pretty heavy then, and he died June the 25th, and I found out in August, and the coroner wrote us a letter, and after he found out that my father, had another family, and they wrote and told us what had happened, and I hated the ground that this stepmother of mine walked on, and it carried, and if I'd have just gone and found this man, if I'd have just looked him up, if I'd have just told him I loved him, I just buried a young cousin here just less than a week and a half ago. He went to work on Monday morning and on Friday morning, and got sick, and they took him home, and Friday night he was dead. And the very thing that has brought me to mind today is the fact if I could have just told him I loved him, if I could have just told him. See, he didn't find the program any more than my father found it. He needed it. And his death certificate is going to say, that he died of a heart attack, but he died of alcoholism. My father died of alcoholism, even if he put the gun in his mouth and blew his head off. He was a very, very sick man. In 1946, I was standing on the street, on the circle, and there was a guy I never brought my dates home. I didn't know what was going to happen, so I never brought him home. And I went to the circle, and I was waiting on a boyfriend that was stationed in the Army, and he didn't show up. And along came three or four soldiers, and there was one, he was tall, and he was redheaded, and he had freckles, and they were all over his body. And I found that out later. We got the information that was needed to start dating, and he walked me back to the bus, and that was in October, and in December we were engaged, and February 1st we were married, of 1947. And I had thought I had met my knight in shining armor. And he told me he was a Mormon. I didn't know what that meant. I just never heard of him before. And we got a letter from his mother, and his mother said she was happy that he had found someone and wanted to get married, but he wished that he had married one of his own kind. Now, that should have told me right then and there, when I set out to become a Mormon, that I was an alcoholic ready to happen, because, man, I'm going to show you, Don't tell me, I'll show you. I'm as good as you are, and, man, I'm going to set out to prove it. And I did. I joined the church, and we went out west, and we met this wonderful family. Opposite the tracks, I'll tell you what. My husband, comes from, a family of 9 boys and 1 girl, and he is absolutely the most wonderful family in the world. I have never seen my father or mother kneel in prayer, and I've seen his. My family would get together and knock down each other and fight and get the guns and the knives out and shoot each other up and end up in jail for the 14th or 15th time. Roy Riddle in for the 14th time. That was my uncle. And we made the paper all the time, we were something else. But, this wonderful family, they go to church, they pay their tithing, they do all the things that my family didn't. And God, I wonder why, what happened to me? When all these things were passed out, what happened to me? Well, the thing happened that I wanted to come back home. Carl took me out there to meet this wonderful family, and I got homesick for my wonderful family back home, and he took me back to Indiana, and we've never left. He's never left. You know, he stayed there ever since. A year after we were married, we had a little girl, Kathy, and 11 months later, we had a little boy, Mike, and 5 years later, we had a little guy named Chuck, and he's my guardian angel. He's the guy that was there when all the drinking was coming down. Now, we were introduced to the Moose, and we were introduced to Canadian Club and Ginger Ale, and at 17, God, you know, I don't know too much about anything. I don't really know too much about love, except I know this guy took me away from all the hell, and he was going, you know, I thought this was wonderful. We moved, and we got a little house, we joined the Moose. Carl brought me back to from Indiana. He adopted my family's lifestyle. He was penny ante poker and weekend parties and booze. And it was, you know, we'd have fights. We'd get angry. And we were doing exactly the same thing that we did when I was a child. And I was busy. I didn't drink too much, but I was busy raising kids and changing diapers and becoming a mother, and all at once, you know, we started going to the Moose, and God, I loved it. I'd gained up to 170 pounds, and I didn't walk, I waddled, and I hated me. And, you know, I just, I wanted desperately to fit. You know, I didn't fit when I was a kid, and I didn't fit when I was a teenager, and I didn't fit when I become this man's wife. I just told you, the opposite attraction of man, I tell you, his family was perfect, and so was he. Or at least that's what I claimed he was, you know. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, and he didn't use God's name in vain, and I did it all. I tried to change that. I tried desperately to become a good, active member of the Latter-day Saint Church. After our kids decided that, you know, I started taking our kids to church, and you know, we decided to try to put our lives together and start doing the things that, you know, that a good parent do. God, I started trying to be a good member. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I quit all these things. I made a decision one day, just like that, and I put the booze down and didn't pick it up for 15 or 16 years. And I'm here to tell you, when I picked the booze back up, I could not put it down. I could not stop drinking. I could quit, but I couldn't stay quit. Oh, man, I tell you, I tried desperately to fit the mold that I thought that a good Mormon wife, you know, was. I tried to sew, I tried to bake, I tried to cook, I had these wonderful children, and I did everything I could in church, I did everything I could in PTA, Little League, you know, all these things. That, you know, what a good mother does. I still couldn't balance the scales. There was something wrong with Clara. And one day I had the opportunity to go to work. Not because I was qualified. I was busy raising kids. I wasn't busy doing nothing else but raising kids and babysitting. And staying in the nursery at the church. You know, the reason I stayed in the nursery was because, see, those kids accepted me just as I was. I was okay. But you people, man, I wasn't okay with you. And you know that what happened was that one day they came to me and said, would you like to go to work? Because, see, my kids had all at once grew up, and I don't know this man I'm married to. I've been married to him for 20-some years, and I don't know him because, see, we talked between our children. We wrapped ourselves up in our kids, and I thought, you know, I didn't have the booze to quiet this hole in my gut, and I thought I was going nuts. You know, I'd go to doctors, and I'd be checked out for ulcers, and you know, for about 5 or 6 years, I never ate a salad. I never did anything, you know, any of the roughages. I went and was treated for ulcers constantly because I was going around with this hole in my gut. Could not figure out what that pain was until one day. One day, the magic happened. I got that job at Keeper Stewart, and I went to you know, work on the liquor order desk, and because I had a gal that was going on maternity leave. This gal was a member of our church, and as I told you, I got the job because I was qualified. I got the job because I was a member of the church, and I didn't drink and I didn't smoke, and they wanted someone that's going to be there and be responsible. And I was for about 3 years. But then all at once, things started changing. The pain in my gut started getting worse, and Clara started, you know, getting crazier every day. You know, things got worse, you know, at home. I didn't want to be Carl's wife anymore. Things got worse at church. Man, I'd be sitting in those pews, and I'd be sweating like hell, and I think, God, aren't they going to shut up? I got to get out of here. And I knew God was going to strike me dead. You know, I just knew He was. And you know, they'd want us to come to their homes, and I thought, man, I just can't stand it. I just can't handle this anymore. And we'd go to these office parties, and my beautiful boss, Mike, he protected me. God, I loved that man. He was the most wonderful Jew you ever met in your life. I mean, and that guy, he just loved us, and he protected me, and he knew that I didn't drink and I didn't smoke, and he always put me right beside him. And whenever they'd come around and they'd say, would you like to have a drink, Mike would say, no, thank you, she doesn't drink, she's a Mormon. And God, I hated that. I hated it. I didn't want to be different. I wanted to be out there where the action was, and one day I realized that. I wanted to be over here where the fun was. I was tired of being good. I don't know about you guys, but I'll tell you what, it was awful hard for me to be good and bad at the same time. And that was, you know, it really, and it got to be harder as it went along. And you know, one day, that beautiful drink, Cold Duck, come out, and that was the magic. That was the magic. After 15 or 16 years, when I put a drink in my gut, when I, you know, Gary talks about the hole in your belly with the wind blowing through it, that was it. And all at once, you know, just a drink, just one glass, and it started, a little bit of the balance started to come. A little bit of the hole started to close. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt exactly what I needed. And from that day forward, I never had a drink in my hand at all times, but I never had a drink out of my mind. And from that day forward, I set out to change, to do everything in my power to have another drink. How can I get him to get away for a weekend? How can I get him to go here? How can I get another drink in my home? You know, I don't want the bishop to know, and I don't want my kids to know, but I got to have a drink, because I knew that that was the thing that made me okay. It made me okay with him at home, you know, in the bedroom. It made me okay at church. It made me okay in the kitchen. It just made me okay. I could tell him to, you know, I could even tell him to go to hell, and I was okay. And see, I never said anything. I never talked back to this man. I had never in my life did anything that, you know, I tried to do what I was supposed to do. A good Mormon wife does those things. Now, you know, the thing I'd like to say real quickly is that I'm not trying to run the church down. I'm telling you, this is exactly the way Clara felt. And this, the church played a great part in my life. And it still does today. The disease ran rampant in me. And, you know, from that day forward, you know, things changed. Wasn't too long till I had to quit that job because my job was going to be terminated or I was going to be fired. And I quit. What does any good alcoholic do? They quit and start a business of their own. And that's what I did. And so, you know, I started Nan's babysitting service. And that's a laugh because I didn't like kids. I found out when I did an inventory, I didn't like kids, you know. God, I don't want to be a babysitter. I raise my kids. And, you know, I did a good job there, too, for about 3 or 4 years. One day, things changed inside of Clara again. Because they see, you know, I babysitted for people that went out of state and out of country, and they left their most precious possessions with Nanny. And they had these wonderful bars, and they were stocked with anything you wanted to drink. They bought it by the case, and it was either in the garage or it was, if we ran out, or in the basement, you know, they just had it. So you had anything you wanted to drink, anytime you wanted to drink it. So I'd tell this guy, you know, these kids getting on my nerves, and I got to have a drink. He didn't say too much. He was a good Al-Anon then, because he didn't want to rock the boat then. You know, he was pretty sick then, you know. So you just kind of go along with it, you know, a little drink. And, you know, and Clara was pretty happy, and things got real good for us for a little bit. And we even had, some fun here and there, and swinging from the chandelier, you know, once in a while. And, gosh, just put a drink in me, and, man, I thought I had the world by the tail. And that changed, too. That changed. Because, you see, Carl had to start staying at night because Nanny was passed out, and I was not able to take care of these children. And then he would have to come home the next day at noon, you know, from work, because Nanny was not able to take care of those children. And when he would come in, these babies would not be got out of their cribs, and they wouldn't have their diapers changed, and they've never been fed. And I'm talking about babies. And maybe the little ones that were supposed to be on the bus and they were supposed to be in school weren't able to make the bus because that Nanny was drunk. And he'd have to come home to make sure that they were, you know, they were fed and they were taken care of. And I'd either be drunk or passed out. There was one time the oven, you know, I was going to clean the oven, and I was drinking really heavy. And I locked this oven door, and I'm in this big, beautiful home, and that, I could never get that thing undone. And, and it just cleaned, and it cleaned, and it cleaned, and the smoke and the fumes just filled the house. Now, I could have burnt that house down, but you see what I did. I went and crawled on the couch and went to sleep, and I called the serviceman the next day, you know, and the stove just kept smelling and smelling, and, you know, the house just kept filling up. And the kids kept saying, you know, Nanny, there's something wrong. And this stove was as hot and as red as it could possibly be. And they said that we don't know what kept this house from burning down. I just thought of that. I called Carl up one day at work. See, I was a runner. This young man, see, whenever Clara would drink and he would disapprove, and he would disapprove real heavy, like he'd raise a lot of hell, and he'd bitch about my drinking. I'd tell him to go to hell, and I'd leave, and I'd get in the car, and I'd go to a motel, and I'd lock myself in, and I'd pay the bill, and I'd buy my booze, pay the bill, lock myself in the room, and I'd stay there, and I'm going to drink, and nobody's going to tell me how to drink. It's my money, and I'm going to drink like I want to drink. The only thing is, I forget that there's a phone there, and I don't know about any of you, but I seem to call people at night when I'm drunk. And they won't let you leave if you don't pay the bill the next day. And So Carl bought me out of that one time. I used to call him up, and he finally got to where he would take the phone off the hook. He got so tired of me calling. And he'd say, "Are you through?" Well, hell no, I wasn't through, because I got to tell him exactly what he's doing to me, because, see, he was the reason I was. He was the reason I drank. He was the reason that, you know, my children weren't home. He was the reason I didn't fit in my home. You know, it was his fault. I got real, real crazy. And they lock you up. As I said, Carl bought me out of it one time. Chuck bought me out of it a couple of times. And then, you know, where you go, they throw your butt in jail. And I don't like jail. One day, I called him up and I said, "If you want these damn kids taken care of, you come home and take care of them. I'm leaving." Now, the parents were in the Philippines, and Nanny's supposed to be taking care of these children. And that's what I did. I packed my clothes and I left. And Carl came home, and 3 days later, here come the parents home, and Nanny's not there. Carl is. I'm drunk somewhere in some motel. He finally gave me a choice, the first of many, and that was that I either got to get help or else. Now, I didn't know what the else was, but I don't want to ever forget where the message came from. The message came from Carl's brother and one of these good Mormon boys that picked up a drink back in the 60s, and this lady was going to church, and she was paying her tithing, and she was the most righteous person in the world, along with the rest of her family. And Art picked up a drink, and isn't it a shame that we got an alcoholic in our home? That we have an alcoholic in our family. If he would do the things that we were doing, he would not, he wouldn't have picked up a drink in the first place. And, I don't want to ever forget that I turned my back on that man and walked away, knowing full well that he had went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought it was an absolute shame. And weren't we glad that we're not going to have anyone like that in our family? He lost his home, he lost his family, and he lost his life. But the message was carried to us early back in the 60s. I'll be forever grateful that it was carried the way that it was carried. I want to tell you that it's not carried that way today, and it doesn't happen that way in Indianapolis today at the central office, because I used to work there up to 2 weeks ago. And, I'll tell you what, when you call there today, if you don't hear it, here's how it is. If you call them, they say, "Do you have a drinking problem?" And if you say yes, I'm supposed to ask you, have you ever been to treatment? Yeah. Do you have a sponsor? Did you get a sponsor? Yes. Do you got numbers? Yes. Well, what else can we do for you? Have you been to AA before? Yes. Well, then you call these people and you go back. We can't get another contact for you. You've got a contact. I'll tell you, the day that I was told that I can't get another contact for an alcoholic that calls, it was the day that my life changed, and my job was no longer important there. Because, you see, there came a day that I could not have called the people that was my first contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. My pride wouldn't have let me. I'd have stayed out there and I'd have died. It takes what it takes, and it took what it took for me. The price was right for me to... What I had to pay was absolutely right, but I'll be forever grateful that you let me come back. However many times it took, over and over and over again, whatever it took, you didn't say, "I can't come back because I've got a pocket full of numbers or a pocket full of sponsors or a pocket full of chips." I had the opportunity to go to Batesville, Indiana, because Carl gave me that opportunity. There was a beautiful lady there, at Central Office, and she was the one that made the connection. I did not make the call. And if you don't make the call, if the drunk don't make the call, I can't help you there either. I didn't make the call. God made it. I told Carl, "If you want me to get help, you call, and I'll go." And that's what I did. I went to treatment in 1976, and December the 9th of 1976, I stayed 14 days, and I was going to stay sober forever. They had the 12 steps on one side and the 12 traditions on the other, and they had a beautiful man that had been there for about 30 years, and God, he was wonderful. And he had a lady Miss Blue, and she was wonderful, and she was a sarge, and she stuck needles in your rear, things were just fantastic. I just thought they made you feel so good. They put these green pajamas on us, and people like me would come in, and they would share their experience, strength, and hope, and I was going to stay sober forever. The only problem was they had some losers there. They'd been through two and three and four times, And I couldn't understand that. I was never going to pick up another drink. I was, you know, as I said, I was going to stay sober forever. I could not understand why it had to take two and three and four times. Carl couldn't understand, you know. I begged to go to Batesville many times afterwards when I went back out. And he said, hell no, you abused the right to go there, lady. He thought one time was it, too. He later changed his mind. I gave him the desire. you know, but it was wonderful. They gave me the how it works, and they let me read it, and I cried, and I knew I had it. I knew how it worked. And they told me to get a sponsor, and they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I was going to do all that. And I walked out of there, and that was December the 23rd, and I went to a New Year's Eve dance for AA, and I got a sponsor, and her name was Hope, and she'd been sober 5 years. And I thought she'd been sober forever. And the only thing that lady could say is, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. And I grew to hate her. And that February 1st rolled around, and nobody was celebrating my anniversary. I'd been married 30 years, so I did. Sound like a good idea to me. I mean, I'm going to meetings, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I thought. But somewhere I missed something, and you know, I couldn't understand that. I was going to meetings, and I'm running like hell, there and here and everywhere. And if you're saying you're an alcoholic, you're saying you're an alcoholic, and I'm saying I'm an alcoholic. You know, what I'm doing, see, I'm wearing a mask. I'm putting on that mask. I'm a conner, and I'm a liar, and I'm a cheat. I'm doing whatever it takes for you. Tell me, you know, I'm to please you. I'm going to do whatever it takes, to, you know, to make you happy. I don't believe it, and I I don't think you're going to know that I picked up a drink. So I'm going to just do whatever I want to do. But when I'm with you, I'm going to, you know, wherever you know the Romans are, you do like the Romans. When I'm with you, I'm an alcoholic. When I'm at the Go Brick, you know, man, I'm Clara, and I'm having a hell of a time. Yeah. I'm chairing meetings. I'm drinking. I go to a conference, and I'm drinking. And I don't think you people know it, you know. I chair one of the most exclusive meetings in Indianapolis. At the club. And the club is where all the old timers go. And God, I want to chair that meeting. And it's for the month. And I know if I chair that meeting, I'm going to be okay. My sponsor told me I'm not supposed to chair meetings until I'm old enough in the program. Well, who in the hell is she? She don't know what I need. She don't know, you know, I'm 47, 48 years old, and she's telling me I can't do these things. No, I got three kids that are in college, you know, and she's telling me, you can't do this? Uh-uh. Not me, baby. I'm going to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, and how I want to do it. Besides that, you know, you people are not going to know. I'm chairing this meeting one day, and Hope walks up the steps and walks into the room, and she walks up to the podium, and she says, I'm taking over. And I said, you're what? She said, I'm taking over. She said, Clara, you have to earn the right to stand up there, and you've been drinking. And from this day forward, you're not chairing this meeting any longer. And I told Hope to go to hell, and I went out and got drunk at her. And I stayed drunk at her for a while. The last of February, Carl and I are having really, really some real heavy debates. I mean, we're fighting over this drinking deal. I mean, he never could take a joke, you know, he just couldn't take a joke. And I've decided, I'm drunk, and I've decided I'm going to make this SOB, the basket weaver, I called him, because, you know, my sponsor said I have to try to clean this up some way. That's not what I called him. And I didn't call him that for a long time. I decided I was going to make him pay. And I'm in the bathroom, and I'm drunk, and I have a glass, and and I break that glass and I cut my wrist, and it took 3 operations to save it. And I'm in that hospital, and you know, and when they get ready to let me out of there, I go directly. You know, oh, I'm praying in there, man. Not, you know, this plastic surgeon comes in and he's telling me all these things he's supposed to do with it about this wrist, and they're going to save my hand. And God, I'm praying to God. You know, I need that hand, and I'm never going to drink again. But it never dawned on me that I was the problem. Never dawned on me. It was him. If I hadn't have been angry, we hadn't have been in a fight, and you know, and he had left me alone, I would never cut my wrist. You know. I walked out of there and went straight to the liquor store. And I went to the liquor store with my arm in a sling. And by June the 9th, I knew I couldn't stay sober. I could not stop drinking. And I knew I was going to end up like my dad. And I just could not stop drinking. I had become a good thief, a good shoplifter. Carl was beginning now to take the checkbook away, the car away, the keys to the car. Hell in our home was terrible. I mean, the fights were terrible. We are now getting physical with our fights, and you know, and I have a knife, and you know, one night, and man, I take this butcher knife and I throw it at him, and I try to, you know, I try to kill him, and he knocked me on my fanny, and that was the, you know, the only time he ever hit me. But I got up and I called the bishop. I would have called the president of the United States if I could have. I called everybody I could call in the Mormon church to tell him what a basket weaver did to me, you know. This good Mormon boy, what he did to this lady. And, you know, it was, never once did I think that it was because of my drinking. That was the reason. Never once was I the reason that this was happening. But the thing happened was that I knew that I was going to end up like my dad. You know, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to die, but I didn't want to die that way. I had, you know, one day my son walked in on June the 9th with him, and I had sent him to the drugstore. And I found this out later. I could not figure out why I had this prescription filled. And it was because of this arm. I had Chuck fill this prescription for me for 100 Darabon. And, you know, all at once, one day the light came on, you know, when the teacher's ready, the pupil, you know, when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears, you know. And all at once, one day, the light went on, and I knew immediately that that's why I had that bottle of, you know, of pills filled. That's exactly why, you know, because I had had to take them because of the, you know, of the pain for this arm when I had the surgery. Well, the 100 Darabon came into my life, and I wanted out. By now, I'm drinking vodka because it doesn't smell, and I've heard you people say that. And I'm well on my way, and I want out. I can't stand the pain in this man's eyes anymore, and I can't stand the pain in my kids' eyes now. This son of mine is home on it from his mission. My two kids, my daughter in Idaho and my son in California, don't want anything to do with their mother any longer. And they want their father to divorce her. They want me out of their life and that for good. And you know, I can't stop drinking. And I take that 100 Darabon with every other pill I've got in the house, and along with that vodka. And the next thing I know, I wake up in intensive care. I can't even die, and I can't even, you know, I can't do that either. And God, you know, I hated God for that, because see, I wanted out desperately. Carl locked me up in the psych ward because he knew I was crazy. But before he locked me up in that psych ward, I spent a few weeks in intensive care. The doctors had told him I wouldn't live through the night, and, you know, he planned my funeral. I didn't, you know, I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know what I was going to do when I woke up. I didn't know where I was going to go. I just knew that if I got out of there, I couldn't stop drinking. And I hated him. God, I hated him. Because he was the reason I was. He locked me up in that psych ward because, damn, he knew I was crazy. Anybody that had cut their wrist and it took three operations to save it, had taken 100 Darovan with every other pill, you know, had done the things that I had done. You know, I had laid my family on the line for a drink. You know, I wished I could make this real funny, but I can't. You know, this is just exactly the way it was, and my sponsor tells me I don't have the right to cheat you. And you know, I was in that psych ward, and I planned his death every day. I became a good patient. I found out how it worked in there. I watched them, and they have levels, you know, and if you're a good patient, man, you get to, you know, different levels, and you get permission to get out of there. They put me on 50 milligrams of Thorazine, and I ended up on 100 milligrams of Thorazine three times a day. And I walked around with that smile on my face, and it was frozen, you know, man, I didn't feel no pain. And, you know, there came a day that I was such a, you know, I learned to make baskets, I learned to make billfolds. And I learned to eat everything on my plate three times a day. I hated breakfast. Still do today. I don't eat breakfast very often. But I did those things because, see, I had to get out of there because I was going to kill this SOB for locking me up. Not one time did they say, "Do you have a drinking problem?" Not one time did they tell me, they asked me about my dad. They asked me about my mom. They asked me about him. But not one time did they say, "Claire, do you have a drinking problem?" When I got out of there, I went directly to the liquor store. And I never stopped drinking from that day forward. Carl would come in at night and he would fix dinner and I'm drinking. And I have this chair, this recliner, and it rocks and I'm sitting there and he'd ask me if I'd like to have something to eat. And I'd say, "Hell no, I don't want to eat." He'd ask me if I'd like to have prayer with him. And I got this drink in my hand and I'd tell him, "You go to hell, you son of a bitch." You know. And people, I've heard people say, you know, that alcoholics don't love their family, and that's a damn lie. My husband would kneel and have prayer at night with my son, and God, I wanted to be there. And I couldn't be there because I laid my family on the line for a drink. I laid my home on the line for a drink. And I laid my life on the line for a drink, and I couldn't be there. I'd die inside because, God, I wanted to fit. And I just couldn't find it. You know, I knew that there wasn't a God. If there'd have been a God, he wouldn't have let happen to me what happened to me. And one day Carl walked in and he said, you know, he had been introduced to Al-Anon and he said, "I love you, but I hate everything that booze is doing to you. And from this day forward, lady, you can go on living, drinking. I'm going on living with or without you." My son said the same thing. And, you know, the two of them went right on. They'd left me. And they would go to their meetings, and I'd say, "You go on to those damn meetings with those, you know, with those bitches, you know." Man, I hated the Al-Anons. I knew they were talking about me. And that's not true. That is absolutely not true. God, you know, I'll tell you what, the day came when I walked into an Al-Anon meeting when I needed to go because, you know, I was dying inside, and my husband looked at me and said, "There's help out there if you want it, but you got to go get it the same way I did, lady." Because I was dying when this brother, you never know when he was going to shoot the house up again, or he's going to try to kill his family, or he was going to blow somebody else away. You know, and I loved that boy, and I couldn't get him sober, and I couldn't keep him sober, and he was dying. And you Al-Anon ladies accepted me just as I was. And I'll be forever grateful for that. Carl looked at me and he said, you know, I'm going to tell you one thing. You know, you can do, you know, you can go on living with, you know, drinking, and I'm going to go on living with or without you. But the one thing I am going to do, I'm going to lock you up in Central State, lady, because I owe your mother. Now, see, Al-Anon, he's going to Al-Anon, and I no longer can cheat him or lie to him. I can't use him. I can't set him up. I can't con him. You know, you women were teaching him well, and I hated you more and more. You know, he didn't care. You just go ahead. I'm just going to lock you up, and here's the papers, man. And I knew he was following through. I knew what was going to happen, and I was scared. See, he'd locked me up once, and that basket weaver wasn't going to lock me up again. Now, I went, and the checkbook's gone now. The keys to the car's gone now. Keys to the house is gone, too. Man, you leave, and he locks the door, and you can't get back in unless you break a window. So I didn't leave too often, unless I was fully prepared. And I wrecked the car one night, and I had this vodka between my legs, and there comes this police car around and flashes a light on me, and I try to hide the bottle, and you know, I spill it all over me, and he opens that door, and he said, "My God, Mrs. Case, you're drunk." And it was one of the kids that my son had graduated from Lawrence Central High School, and he was the policeman that arrested me. Yeah. That hasn't happened since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Just hasn't happened. I went to the bank, and I had to try to figure out something. I had to figure out somewhere to go and something to do, and I don't know why I thought of San Diego, but I knew that I was going to, you know, I wanted to go where it was warm. I didn't like cold weather, and I, you know, and San Diego sounded like a good idea at the time, but I didn't have any money. So I went over to the bank, and I, you know, I acted like a lady. It got all cleaned up, and I went in there, and I told them I lost my checkbook, and they knew me, and they said, "Well, how much do you need, Mrs. Case?" And they gave me one of these blank checks, you know, white checks, and I wrote that out, and I said, "Oh, I wrote it out for $250. Now, that's not going to get you very far when I'm going to go and put my life together. So I wrote out, you know, I just thought I'd just clean the checkbook out. And so that's what I did. I bankrupt this man. I took every bond he had, every bit of the savings he had, and everything he had in the checkbook. And I got on a Greyhound bus, taxi out there waiting on me, took every stitch of clothes I had from day one, 30 years, married, took everything, not leaving a thing for him, nothing. Got on a Greyhound bus, and I'm going to go to San Diego and put my life together. Who in the hell needs this family anyway? Not me. I'll show them. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to get myself together, and I'm going to quit drinking, and I'm going to be okay. And I stay at the Penwick Hotel, and it's connected onto the Greyhound bus station, and there's only one thing wrong. They have fabulous bars and sailors. And I had a good time. One day, I got in a taxi, and I'm going to go see the city, I guess. I don't know. The next thing I know, I'm on Skid Row. And there's a little man there, and he said, "Lady, you don't belong here." And I don't know how long I've been there. I don't know how I got there. I just know I did whatever it took to get a drink. Now, here was a lady that had been married 30 years, had 3 beautiful kids, 8 beautiful grandchildren, and I was a lady at one time. I mean, up here. And, man, I went just like that, right down the slide. You know, I was willing to do whatever it took to get a drink. I was willing to become a prostitute and a whore for a drink. I paid the price. Whatever it took. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and one day, I woke up in the Penwick Hotel, and it was on a Sunday morning. I don't know how I got there. I don't know who I was with. I just know that I didn't want to drink no more. I wanted to be sober more and I wanted to be drunk, and God, I would, you know, I didn't know what to do. Other than the fact that I remembered all those losers in Batesville that had been through 3 and 4 times, and that's where I was got to go. That's where I had to get back to Batesville, where you understood me. I shipped my clothes back to Carl, and I got a ticket on a trailway bus, and I went to Batesville, Indiana, and I left San Diego. It was 78 degrees, and I got in Batesville, Indiana. It was 29 below zero, and that was January the 19th of 1970, January the 18th of 1978. I stayed at the Sherman House, and my last drink was cold duck. How ironic that is. I started out on cold duck, ended up on cold duck. And they didn't have any taxis in that little town, and they, you know, and one of the maids came and took me over to the hospital. January the 19th of 1978 was my last drink. I stayed 9 days on the hospital side because I was mighty sick. And one day Butch came over. They called Butch, and he came over, and he, you know, he leaned down at the bed, and he gave me a kiss, and I looked up at him, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because, you know, man, that beautiful man. He said, "Clara, you tried it your way. Why don't you try it ours?" And God, I wanted to. After that 9th day, they wheeled me over to Serenity Hall, and they put the green pajamas back on me, and it was freedom from bondage. Nothing had changed. Absolutely nothing had changed. They still had Miss Blue. They still had the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. They still had all these people that had been through there 2, 3, and 4 times were coming back. Nothing had changed. They still had people like me that were coming in there sharing their experience, strength, and hope. The only thing that had changed was me. I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to be drunk. And I was willing to do whatever it took to stay sober. They told me to get a sponsor. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And they, you know, and I wanted to do that. They told me I had a right to be right and a right to be wrong. And they told me I counted. And God, I didn't know I counted. I'll be forever grateful to the counselor that was there and was my counselor. And her name was Lita. And God, she was beautiful. And she was put there just for me. Because she taught me that, you know, that I was a lady. And she taught me that, you know, how to be a lady again. And she, you know, she allowed me the right to come in there each and every day. And talk with her on a daily basis for almost a year. Because, you see, I went home after I got through treatment, and he didn't know what to do with me. And I didn't know what to do with him. God, I was scared to death of him. He found out where I was at and asked if he could come down and see me, and we decided to try it one more time, one day at a time. And I went home to that house, and we walked on eggshells. And I'll be forever grateful that I had a little trailer, and we put that trailer down on Joey Lake, and it was 14 miles from town. And this lady had been married 30 years, and I had never stayed alone until I started drinking, and, you know, never been alone. And it was God and me and the horse, maybe a cow now and then, and out there and with this trailer. And I went every day to the treatment center, and they allowed me to sit in those meetings. They allowed me to share. You know, it's not that way today. Isn't it funny, you know, what God does for us when we can't do for ourselves? My life has been made a 180-degree turn. When I walked out of there, Butch told me I had to get active in my own recovery, and on December the 4th of 1978, we pulled that trailer off of Joy Lake. And went back to Indianapolis. And I was scared to death. And I started getting active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started chairing meetings. And I'm looking for a sponsor. And I haven't got one yet. And at 10 months, see, I'm going to get the right sponsor this time. I'm using the group, and I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm not drinking. I'm going to stay sober, but I want to do everything different this time. You know, and I'm chairing meetings. I'm even invited down to Greensburg, Indiana to share. 18 months in the program, I'm here to tell you I'm capable of doing the same thing sober as I did drunk. At 18 months in the program, we had... this man's not paying attention to me. This man, you know, all he talks about is the declarer that was, not the declarer that is today. I'm trying to put my life together. I'm not drinking. Man, the only thing I was doing was not drinking. I mean, you know, other than that, everything else is the same in our household. And I'm standing at the sink, and I've got this same butcher knife that I threw at him when I was drunk. And I turn, and I throw that butcher knife, and I stick it right in the floor, right in front of him. And I could have threw it through him. And I knew. And I was crazy. And I left. And I got in the car and I went to the club. And the guys were there. And they held on to me. There weren't any gals there. The guys were there. And I'll be forever grateful for you, AA men. You know, that told me, you know, we're going to do this. And I went to a candle that night. And when they brought me back, you know, they said, now you be here at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and Mary Jane's going to be here. Now you be here and you ask her to be a sponsor. I did just that. I knew she couldn't and she wouldn't because she sponsored so many people. But I knew I had to do something, and you guys were staying sober. And I was scared I was going to drink again. I asked Mary Jane to be my sponsor, and you know, I'll tell you what, you know, from that day forward, that lady looked at me and she said, you know, I only sponsor people that are willing to stay sober and willing to work the program, and sickies up front. I said up front today, I'm willing to stay sober, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober, and that's been 11 and a half years ago. Now, I'll tell you, I have babies of my own that I have to walk what I talk because they see to it. You know, I can't con them, I can't lie to them, I can't cheat them. And I have to walk the spiritual principles as well, you know, and that means I can't do anything you can't see. I heard a beautiful lady the other day, Angie, and she said you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit. And you know what? I love that. And I'm going to use that with my babies, you know. You can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit. And man, I tell you, you know, my babies say, but you don't understand, Clara. You got a husband. You don't understand. You know, I'm lonely. You don't understand. I got to have somebody here, just somebody to hold me for tonight. Yeah, I understand. You know, let me tell you about the pain. Let me tell you where it was at. I understand. The thing I do know today is that I know how to stay sober, and I know that what it takes for me to stay sober on a daily basis. And my babies and I walk together, and we share the program together, and my husband and I, we share the program together, and it's, you know, and it's not, we're not Mr. and Mrs. AA and Al-Anon, but we are both willing to do what it takes to stay sober and sane and to practice the principles in all of our affairs. And our girls know it, and our guys know it. And, you know, it's a neat way of life. Things have changed, and I'll quickly share with you that things have changed in my life here lately. You know, I've, in quitting work, you know, I thought that the whole world was going to be okay, and things were going to be just wonderful, and I'm going out west, and I got these trip tickets, and I'm coming here to, you know, then we're going to Arizona, and we're going to share there, and then we're going to San Diego, and on around, and all at once, things change, you know, Carl has to have some surgery. Well, that's okay now today, because you see, we've turned it over to God, but for a few minutes, Clara, it really rocked me. Our lives have changed because Carl's retired, and, you know, and me quitting, I'm trying to do some things in my life today that I didn't think I was able to do. And that's get closer to God, more active in Alcoholics Anonymous, more active in the church, and put the balance in there that I don't know what the hell is. You know, I don't know what the balance is. I hear you people talk about balance, but I don't know what it is. I just know whatever it takes for me to stay sober, I'm willing to do it. I've gotten real hungry and real God conscious in the last fall, and I just know that it makes me real comfortable to be here. It makes me real comfortable to kneel in prayer today, and you've given me that. At 6 years in the program, I had not been inside of a chapel. I was at a retreat because my sponsor told me to be there. At 6 years in the program, she asked me to go to the chapel on Sunday morning. And I sat in the back of the room, and she walks in, and she walks around, and she comes over to the far side of the room of the chapel, and she kneels down, and she said, "Sickie's up front." She takes my hand, and she walks me up, and she sits me down on the front row. And from that day forward, Claire was okay with God, and I was okay with me. And I was able to go and clear away the wreckage of the past, you know, and I was able to make amends to the church and meet with the bishop and accept the consequences of my actions, excommunication or disfellowship. I was able to do whatever it took to stay sober. And today, you know, God and I walk hand in hand, and you know, and I can walk into the chapel and it's just okay. I'm comfortable in our church, and I'm just okay. And I'll be forever grateful to you because you're the ones that gave me that. I had a magazine that used to come, you know, and that magazine was the church magazine. I don't know what it was called, but it was a church magazine. And I used to burn that sucker up because I hated that church. You know, I hated it, you know, because I was bad and he was good. And I hated it. And that magazine would come every month and I'd burn it up. I'm here to tell you, I got to tell you now, if you got anyone you want to plant the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous and you want to irritate the shit out of them, you send them the Grapevine. If they're still drinking, that magazine comes every month in a little brown paper envelope, and, you know, it'll just irritate them. But it'll plant the seed. Because, see, that's what happened here. It came every month. And one day, Clara was sober. And one day I picked up that magazine, and one day I opened it, and they were talking about alcoholism and the disease of alcoholism. And it got my attention. And inside was this little poem. Now, I haven't seen any articles like that since or before. See, again, God did for me what I needed to have done. Because I see on a daily basis, I have to be reminded of where I came from and where I would go if I pick up a drink again. I don't care if it's your kid or whose kid or your wife or, you know, whose wife or your life, or I don't care. Whatever it takes for me, if I pick up a drink, whatever it takes for me to get a drink, I'll get behind the wheel of a car and I'll go. I'm not the least bit afraid of getting behind the wheel of a car with a drink in my hand. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. I'm willing to pay the price. In fact, I don't even think of the consequences. I used to tell Carl, it's nobody's business what I drink. And that's what this poem's entitled, and I'd like to close with it. It's nobody's business what I drink. I care not what the neighbors think or how many laws they choose to pass. He'll tell the world I'll have my glass. Here's one man's freedom that can't be curbed. My right to drink is undisturbed. So he drank in spite of law of man and got into his old tin can. Stepped on the gas and let it go down the highway to and fro. He took the curves at 50 miles with blurry eyes and a drunken smile. Not long till a car he tried to pass, and there was a crash, a scream and breaking glass, and the other car was upside down about 2 miles from the nearest town. The man was clear, but his wife was caught, and she needed the help of that drunken sot who sat in a muddle and drunken daze and heard the screams and saw the blaze. It was too far gone to save the life by lifting the car off the wife. The car was burned and a mother died while a husband wept and a baby cried. And a drunk sat by, and still some think it's nobody's business what we drink. I'm Claire Case and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.